You're now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. My name is Wynn Lemons. I'm a member of the Ventures team here at Delphi, and I'm joined today by Connor Moore and David Choi of MetaStreet DAO. MetaStreet is a liquidity scaling protocol for NFT credit markets. More tangibly, MetaStreet serves to increase efficiency within NFT financing markets by facilitating diversified credit exposure for investors and market liquidity for loan originators. Today, we will be discussing NFT lending markets and the troubles with scaling, MetaStreet DAO and the pain points it's addressing, and gamifying governance and user education, as well as the future of metaverse capital markets. With that being said, let's get to it. Pleasure to have you guys on the podcast. How are we doing?
Great. Thank you for having us on the show. Very excited.
Cool. Well, it's good to see you. I'm always eager to talk to you all. So I think it would help if we just start off with a little bit of background.
Absolutely. I think it might be best if maybe, this is David, if I start off a little bit about my background and kind of how Connor and I started working together early on and since August last year. Cool. So from the start, I actually studied art history. That was my field of study, as well as finance, but it's not as cool to talk about. My first stint out of college was actually doing art lending, so like collateralizing like Warhols, Frank Stellas, Robert Indiana's, to provide loans against those assets in 2014. And this was like pretty early art financialization, and it was just interesting like financial modeling that we're doing, like essentially CLE specs of artworks and doing like almost like a put option or an option valuation on the underlying asset in order to price it because it was a sale leaseback. And after that, I worked at Deutsche Bank where I met Connor in the real estate gaming, lodging, leisure division. So casinos, shopping malls, and mobile gaming, where we dealt with larger sized debt products and for especially hard assets as a primary focus. And yeah, I got into, I guess, crypto investing on more on the venture side and angel investing side, I guess, before those concepts even existed in 2017. It was more so like gas bombing all the way to ICOs, which was trying to democratize the efforts early on. Ever since then, I've invested quite a bit. I've joined a few DAOs, such as like Pleasure DAO and like Seed Club and a few others. Most recently, I invested in NFT lending protocols. And I've noticed that it was kind of hard to get a loan and also how to give a loan for most users. I've had personal experience with regards to lending against like illiquid chunky assets that have a strange mark-to-market industry. But I thought I could bring those skills into changing the risk dynamics of giving liquidity to NFT collateral in a more efficient way. Because right up until now, it's been peer-to-peer. So people have to like look at a CryptoPunk. How do you determine the rates and the LTVs and stuff like that? And the work to actually do that is actually quite... It's a lot of effort to get like a very small yield, and which is why the rates on these loans were really high, like 40 to over 100 APYs. So yeah, Connor and I were just chatting about like how do we scale this industry, because we know it's going to happen, but we want to do it in an efficient way. So we kind of wanted to build like almost like a Fannie Mae, but for NFT credit markets. And yeah, Connor had some experience in the industry as well in scaling it. So I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah. Thanks for having us on, Wynn. So my personal background's all in traditional finance. Started my career in investment banking, and then working in private equity, and always kind of with a focus on real estate markets. And at the last private equity fund I was working at, one of the big initiatives that we drove was investing in kind of single family rentals across the US. And so if you think about, you know, our last fund total was about $6 billion and, you know, 30 or 40 investment professionals. And so if you think about, you know, deploying capital at scale into houses that cost, you know, 200 grand a pop with 30 people, you know, that's pretty difficult to do, right? And you're probably not going to do that efficiently if you're underwriting individual assets. And so the way we kind of solved for that was we looked at where debt capital markets were pricing big portfolios of single family rental product. And ultimately worked backwards from there. And you could basically determine the right kind of geographic mix, bed bath count, you know, age of home and things like that, based on seeing where kind of the debt markets were pricing these big portfolios. And what that ultimately meant was it was sort of a top-down approach where you could look at where DCM was pricing things and then go and say, okay, based on this, I can buy these properties sort of sight unseen. And that concept of kind of debt markets scaling, you know, individual asset underwriting was something that we thought could be applied to the NFT space as well. In particular, like David was saying, the analogy of Fannie Mae for NFT credit markets. You know, if you think about how Wells Fargo or Bank of America originates a mortgage against your house, you know, you get these instant terms, 95% LTV, 2% interest rate, whatever. And they're doing that because they're selling that exposure to Fannie Mae. And Fannie Mae is able to do that because they're ultimately selling that exposure into kind of pieces for investors to kind of get like an optimal risk return profile. And so if you look at the NFT credit market, you know, when we started this project, there had been $15 million worth of loans ever done. And that was compared to about $15 billion worth of transaction volume. And so that kind of sub 1% penetration rate, you know, whether NFT credit markets look more like art lending, which is about a 10% penetrated market on, you know, a couple trillion dollars worth of assets, or as they get more sophisticated, if they look more like, you know, mortgage industry and the real estate industry, which is, you know, 50% penetrated on about $40 trillion worth of assets. You know, it's certainly more than, you know, 1%. And so the question was kind of like, well, what's the problem here? And if you looked at the peer-to-peer markets, and as David was saying, you know, 40 to 50% APRs were pretty standard and still are quite standard in that market. And the reason is because a peer-to-peer lending model is just really capital inefficient. And so if you think about, you know, a lending club, for example, you know, the way lending club works in reality is there's really three or four institutions that run almost all of the volume through lending club. Or if you look at the responsibility on a peer-to-peer marketplace of an individual who has to, you know, do the labor of sourcing the loan, underwrite the loan themselves, and then provide the capital themselves, you can understand why an average person would want, you know, a really high APR for that. But that ultimately limits kind of the total potential for this market. And so the idea behind MetaStreet was basically to create that secondary market aggregation vehicle that allows for all these peer-to-peer marketplaces to sort of self-organize. And so what I mean by that is basically MetaStreet vaults sit one layer behind the peer-to-peer marketplaces. They buy the loans that originators are originating and thereby allow the originator to go from running sort of their own little mini bank to becoming more of like an originator that's running a volume-based business. At the same time, that allows kind of passive capital to come in and sit in these vaults and get exposure to this market without having to do anything more than just kind of depositing their capital. So it's sort of the separation of labor and expertise from the capital providing side of the equation. And the idea is like by separating those two components, you allow far more efficient markets to exist. And so that's basically, you know, the idea behind MetaStreet. And as you know, we've been building, you know, a lot of the product, but also kind of running this sort of, I would call like a decentralized credit fund almost, in effort to kind of prove out this thesis over the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. So I think maybe we'll definitely get to the evolution of MetaStreet DAO itself, but I want to keep elaborating on the actual lending markets themselves. So with these high APRs that you're seeing, over the last few months or over the course of, you know, the time since you've started MetaStreet DAO, have you seen more players come in? I mean, you know, you would expect the market to become more efficient over time and see these yields come down. We've certainly seen a proliferation of, you know, lending platforms for sure, which we can talk about those in a minute. But
we've seen the volume. When we first started, I think the total volume ever done for NFT collateralization was 15 million total, like across all of history. And that was back in August 2021. Today, it's 10x that since then in a matter of months. We ourselves, we've provided about 30 mil of the, you know, 120, 150 volume ever done. Because we really covered one market, which was the CryptoPunk market. We've also provided a few more, liquidity for, you know, a few other assets like Bored Ape Yacht Club and Autoclips, but the punk market was just extremely efficient in terms of finding a proper interest rate and also volume and LTVs, where people were the bid ask was kind of converging. We're now about 90% of the of all loans ever done for CryptoPunks, obviously growing that market. But in terms of sophisticated players that are coming in, it's been mostly individuals. We've seen some groups come in, which we're hoping to work with our platforms, because we're almost sitting between these large participants as like the loan aggregator. And they're obviously doing their expertise and deploying their capital and then reselling it to us. So we're seeing like P2P like really explode in terms of scale and operations, and we were kind of part of that process with our specific coverage of CryptoPunks. And we've seen, because we've started covering the CryptoPunk lending market, we've seen a compression in the interest rates, but also a massive increase in volume, which is kind of where the market is supposed to move towards.
Yeah, I think one of the cool things about the CryptoPunk example specifically is we were able to kind of see that real-time rate compression of, you know, 40% before we started to, you know, bringing interest rates for those assets all the way down to kind of the 10-15% range. And even the idea of like self-organization without kind of directly originating loans on the platform itself has already started to kind of happen. So like in that, the latest kind of portfolio deal that we did on the batch of 104 CryptoPunks, we were seeing a lot of other bidders who were basically bidding really close to the terms that we were proposing. And that's literally exactly what we want to have happen. So we want to basically have everyone that's participating on these marketplaces to know like they have an exit on their loan at X terms. And so you might as well originate something that's pretty close to those terms, because you have kind of this secondary aggregation. And so that was cool to see happen like real time in sort of this CryptoPunk experiment.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting to see the market get more efficient as you've helped be an integral part in scaling it, and then also as competitions recognize the yield. I think we would be remiss not to talk about a few of the premier loans that you've had. So could you elaborate on the process of underwriting that 104 CryptoPunk collection? If I recall correctly, that was a collection that was going to be listed on Sotheby's and ultimately was canceled. And then I guess the holder has now been looking for liquidity.
Yeah, I guess it was a evolving process. It's not something I don't think we could have been that confident about from day one, but because we've done so much volume, we've done about like 3% of the entire CryptoPunk market, so like 300, we've provided a liquidity for. It was an evolving experiment that we've kind of ran with this credit fund before it's evolving into, you know, the Fannie Mae, which eventually evolves into like almost the Federal Reserve, but I'll talk about that in a minute. We started off, as Connor was saying, at the market rate when we first started back in August, which was like 40-70% interest rates, which is tough to, if you're a borrower, why would you take it 40 or 70, right? That's not, how do you make money off of that? It's a pretty tough number to beat. So we just kind of started there. And with this DAO that we have, we kind of lowered it every month by like 10% and try to figure out if there is a lot of liquidity to be, you know, granted to CryptoPunks, when will our vaults kind of cap out in terms of like a closed, like human powered DAO before it turns into something that's automatic, which is what we're launching in a few weeks. So as we like went down from 40 to 30 to 20, eventually to 10% interest rates, that's when our vaults kind of capped out. And there's really three metrics that you're calculating for, which is almost like a new calculation for a weighted average cost of capital, you know, WACC to the finance geeks out there. But there's the LTV, which is kind of like the collateral value and how the loan might be underwater, because these aren't cash flow generating assets. There's no, like, that pay down. It's just a blue payment at the very end. So we just have to make sure at the expiration of, you know, 90 day term, that the collateral isn't lower than the actual capital provided. And that's a data science problem, really. It's looking at historically, like, what is the peak to trough analysis? So that can be solved even before an engagement is started. Same with kind of convexity / the duration, which is, say, a 30 versus 90 day term. Like, obviously the volatility is going to increase as the time increases of a loan. But both of those, like, you know, mean regression calculations, peak to trough analysis, that can be calculated. So two out of the three numbers can be solved for. The interest rate couldn't be. That's more like, where's the market? And the reason that 10%, it actually, like, capped out fully, like, we're more than maxed out, and we're getting still significant demand for these rates, is because that's when you can actually make money. Before the 104 punk loan, we actually did 101, actually the week after the Sotheby's event happened. It's kind of how 650D, like, found out about us and realized that this was a new option for him. And we did that for another client that was unrelated to 650D. And we were able to use our method to kind of discover that 10% is actually a very competitive rate, because the bar we just put in an anchor at 20%. It's making 10% spread. And then, you know, a few weeks after that, 650D, like, you know, in the real world, every time you need liquidity on a house, you don't sell it. You get a loan against it, or you mortgage it. That's like the way chunky assets have worked. And even though punks have, like, pretty high mark to market, the best way to solve for liquidity problems for big assets like these, whether it's real estate or artwork, things that are chunky and not really a money market, like, you know, crypto, like Aave, is to borrow against it. So this, to him, it made sense because he was still getting the liquidity that he was interested in, and he still had the upside exposure, because the day that auction happened, I mean, I think it's also the day that the war started in Ukraine. So it's not a great market. And so it was tough for him to, like, really find the right market to make that trade worth it. So he came to us and said, like, this is an interesting option, because we did 101 and he had 104. So given our back calculations and what we showed him in terms of the analytics, it was a no-brainer for him.
That makes a ton of sense. And so as you, the interest rate that you just pointed out, well, actually, two questions. So I think we didn't really cover it earlier, but structurally, how are most of these loans underwritten in the peer-to-peer marketplace? Like, how long are they usually outstanding? You know, you've discussed the interest rates a little bit as they've come down. How does liquidation actually happen if a borrower doesn't pay?
Yeah, so I would say, so Niftify has kind of been the main peer-to-peer market to date. And up until their V2 a couple of days ago, they had four fixed duration options. It was 7, 30, 60, 90, I think, or 7, 30, 90, maybe three options. So all of the loan durations kind of fit into that bracket. Lenders are generally most comfortable with those loan durations, because if you think about the actual amount of time that most of these NFT projects have even existed, you know, you're maybe a couple of years. So taking on, you know, longer than a year's worth of duration or something like that is pretty off-putting to most lenders. And then the actual kind of, you know, valuation side of things, I would say generally most LTVs on these assets are kind of in the market around 30 to 50% of value. And you know, you could kind of deliberate on value a lot of different ways, but for the sake of simplicity, let's just say value is kind of floor price. So 30 to 50% LTVs, that's pretty synonymous with kind of traditional art lending markets. And the liquidation, I think it's important to note that any peer-to-peer contract, there's no, you know, inter-duration liquidation process. So the lender is basically agreeing to either the principal plus interest or collateral back at the end of the duration of the loan in question. And so any peer-to-peer contract is going to look like that. And that's really a good thing for the kind of stability of this market. David's touched on this a little bit, but kind of contrasting the idea of sort of a money market format versus a mortgage, you know, agreement in the traditional finance like analogy, where Aave and Compound, those are money markets for crypto. But NFTs aren't, you know, they're not fungible tokens that are trading millions and millions of dollars worth of volume every day. They're usually pretty thin liquidity. The value itself is part art, part science for sure. And so the agreement of having kind of a peer-to-peer contract, fixed duration, fixed interest rate, is really a lot more appealing to borrowers as far as we've seen, relative to something where it's supposed to look like a money market and you have like liquidation risk and there's like price oracle dependency and things like that. Because candidly, these aren't assets that make sense to be sitting in a money market. You know, it's not like commercial paper or something like that. We also think that over time, just to kind of expand on that peer-to-peer versus peer-to-pool, I guess, strategy, over time, you know, as you think about this space evolving and GameFi evolving and play to earn and all the guilds that have sprung up in the last kind of 18 months, you know, these are true operating businesses. And so as an operating business, you need a fixed cost of capital to run whatever your business is. So if you're speculating within, you know, crypto markets and you want to, you know, lever up to short you know, Ethereum or something, it makes total sense to do that on Aave. And Aave is floating rate and it should be, and that's great. You don't care, you know, on your 1 day duration, you know, loan, you don't care that it's floating rate. But if you're borrowing against a portfolio of Axies or something like this, as an example, and you're then turning around and renting those out or doing like a profit share agreement with scholars, you need a fixed cost of capital that you're ultimately like levering up that position in order to kind of like run the rest of that operating business. So we really like that peer-to-peer contract format because we think that there's some kind of further down the line benefits of having something that's fixed duration, fixed interest rate for people to ultimately like leverage in how they're running a business on the other side, on the borrowing side.
Yeah. No, that's you know, one of the first times that we spoke, that's what really, you know, clicked for me about the business model and about the peer-to-peer lending was similar to the point that you said earlier. You know, in the real world with hard assets, if somebody owns a piece of fine art, they aren't selling that when they want liquidity against it. They're taking a loan against it, getting it appraised. And, you know, ultimately there's a liquidation event that happens for Picasso. It's just, if you don't repay the loan, then you default. And that point about having a fixed cost of capital is also really interesting. I was curious, do you think there's a timeline where, you know, bigger collections, say the Bored Ape Yacht Club, that do have liquidity at the floor, granted not the same liquidity as, you know, trading Ethereum or another token, but do you think there's a timeline where there's a bifurcation in the market where loans kind of for floor level assets are peer-to-pool? And we may need to explain what peer-to-pool is for listeners that may not be privy. And then like higher end assets like Goldford Apes or Alien Punks, they're more of that peer-to-peer marketplace where those would be written on like underwritten on like an origination, like a bespoke basis.
I think it could happen, but I think what's important to note is kind of like how these contracts are interacted with. If they're being interacted with another contract, or if they're just being if you assume that these peer-to-pool are just forever going to be interacted with individuals and humans. But if you're looking at like, say, if you want to borrow against an asset but also rent it out, for example, like there's a lot of renting protocols coming out. It's kind of hard to borrow something and then you rent it out, and you can also get liquidated on the asset in the middle of your operating agreement. Or say if you're playing a game and it's like living in a house and the Zillow index goes up and then you get liquidated and the house you're in, you're like, okay, it's gone, it's not mine, you gotta get out. But yeah, it's kind of tough to interact with these protocols. But if it's a floor asset and it's truly a collectible asset and it's truly a commodity that isn't going to be used during the period for other purposes, then I could see peer-to-pool be interesting because it's really just another currency that you're dealing with, a very liquid asset. It's kind of why stock is called stock, because it's literally paper and a representation of an asset. It's supposed to be extremely liquid. Same thing with like a currency. But an NFT is kind of a precious asset to most individuals, whether you're playing AIM or you're representing it as a part of your identity. So getting liquidated on your identity isn't the most appealing idea. And as Connor was saying, fixed rate, fixed duration is really the first time you've actually kind of needed that in the metaverse. Whereas in crypto, short fixed term, fixed duration is still kind of having like its product market fit, like kind of a era where it's trying to figure out the exact users for that. But in the metaverse, it's almost second, like it's almost common sense to have that kind of structure. The one thing I would like to add though is, in the future, like we do see almost like an inevitability of kind of everything getting leveraged in the future in terms of hard assets, much like in real estate, it's like upwards of more than 50% in some industries, so it's plus 90%. Once everything's levered and borrowed against and financialized, especially for a longer term, this is kind of why the US cares about the FOMC meetings, because once everything's leveraged, it's not getting a borrow that matters, it's the interest rate. And the interest rate's the only thing that matters, because every single asset, say in the US or in the real estate market, that's all connected to the interest rate. And that's kind of what we want to clarify on what we're building. Yes, we're creating the secondary aggregation vehicle, but the interest rate and how that's determined through MetaStreet is all that's going to matter in the future. And that's what, and that's our conviction. We're already collateralizing about 3% of the entire CryptoPunk supply right now. And if that goes up to 10%, the interest rate related to, say, like 10 to 15% of the entire CryptoPunk market, it's going to matter significantly for the entire health of the entire collectibles market. And that's our firm belief into the future, is that these rates, well, they kind of dictate how the market will grow, how to subsidize them, all the way to how to grow them. And it might matter all the more as you have this cold start problem with metaverses, because cost of capital is really the ultimate goal for galvanizing GDP of a new nation, metaverse, or proto nation.
We can get into the kind of like vault makeup in more detail, but I think the cool thing about a vault product is that it's modular by nature. So, you know, if it makes sense to have one format of underwriting and loan agreement for a certain type of asset, for example, like you were saying, sort of floor level collectibles versus another type of asset that's, you know, being used in rental agreements, that second type of asset will be in its own, you know, vault. And so that vault will have its own, can have its own valuation parameters and its own kind of unique attributes that operate separately. And the idea, right, for us, like our goal is that MetaStreet is just thought of as sort of the base liquidity layer for the entirety of the NFT credit market. And from a capital depositor standpoint, you'll basically just mix and match, you know, a vault with, you know, different vaults that you want exposure to, and then within those vaults, different tranches of risk and return profile. And ultimately, all of these origination platforms or peer-to-pool platforms will kind of just plug into one liquidity layer and get access to, you know, volume for whatever their specific business is.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, I mean, I think at this point, it would be instructive if you maybe walk us through where MetaStreet is now and where it's going. You know, you've touched on a few different elements of the business model, but I think an overview and maybe the vision of what MetaStreet hopefully becomes might be helpful as we move the conversation forward.
Yeah, so what I'll do is I'll start with sort of the mechanics of how this all works, and then I'll turn it over to David to talk about, you know, the longer term vision of where we see this going in, you know, a couple of years' time. But so mechanically, just to kind of give you the rundown. So like I said, peer-to-peer agreement happens on peer-to-peer platform. And when the lender makes that agreement, they mint a new NFT that's represented as a promissory note in their wallet. And that NFT represents the rights to either the principal and interest or the underlying collateral, right? And right now, the way it works is all of those lenders just hold that NFT in their wallet and nothing happens to it. Now with MetaStreet vaults existing, they'll be able to basically go to that vault and they'll be able to see real-time pricing on the NFT loan that they're holding, what MetaStreet vault will pay for that loan right now at this very moment. And the way that MetaStreet is determining what they'll pay for that is that sort of weighted average cost of capital calculation that David was talking about. So, you know, there's basically, it's a summation of three kinked linear formulas where there's a different interest rate associated with different LTVs, durations, and also overall vault utilization, cash utilization. So the vaults will basically have a different price that they'll pay for those loans at any given time. So to walk you through an example, you originated a 90-day loan, and it was a 15% APR against a CryptoPunk. And at the time, that loan correlated to, on MetaStreet's calculation, a 40% LTV. And then 30 days have gone by, and the underlying collateral value has gone up, which means that the value of your loan has gone up, or in other words, your LTV has gone down. And so now what MetaStreet will pay for that loan, where you originally originated 15% APR, now MetaStreet will pay an effective 10% APR, let's say, as an example. And so there's a present value gain that you can capture by basically selling your higher cash flows at a lower interest rate. This is just like, sort of standard fixed income math, but this is how that process works. And so you can benefit from a change in the value of your asset, a change in the duration of the loan. So that's, the duration, you had 90 days of exposure, now it's only 60 days of exposure. And then the third thing you can benefit from is sort of the underlying demand for that loan, which is represented by the cash utilization in the MetaStreet vault. So if MetaStreet vaults were totally capped out, they're not going to pay you very much money for that loan, right? Because they don't have very much money to pay. But if the MetaStreet vaults have a ton of cash in them, that basically means that there's more demand for these loans than there is supply. And therefore, you should realize, a present value gain on your loan. So mechanically, that's how it works. And the vaults themselves are separated by different asset types. So you have a collectibles vault, play-to-earn vault, land vault, right? All these different types. And then within that vault, there's different NFTs that are like getting allocation. And those different NFTs are getting allocation based on a governance process that's basically dictating where liquidity flows for those different NFTs. And then the last bit I'll mention is that the vaults on the capital depositor side are split into different kind of seniority. So there's senior position and junior position within each vault. And basically the senior position is getting a fixed interest rate, but the junior position is getting a variable interest rate. And that spread allows for basically you as a capital depositor to kind of get like your optimal risk return profile. Where if you are really risk averse, you're going to come into the senior position because it's more kind of protected from defaults. And if you are more risk loving or you want higher returns, you're going to come into the junior position where you have higher risk of default, but higher returns. So that's the mechanics. And I don't know if that like was too detailed or if you want me to explain anything in more detail or maybe more high level. But I also want David to kind of hop in here and talk vision on kind of a couple of years down the line where we see this going.
Yeah, I think maybe we pause here before we move on to like the vision and unpack a little bit of what you just talked about. So I think one of the things that's definitely key that's interesting is, having that liquidity available for the originators that you pointed out. If I've held my CryptoPunk loan that I've underwritten for 30 days, but I want liquidity today, having the optionality to sell that to MetaStreet is a great way to increase, overall activity within the market itself. And then the vault side of it obviously is very interesting from capital allocation perspective, right? Because now people can assess, their risk appetite, and also it's a way to gain exposure to these NFT collateralized loans without having to do the origination themselves. So I think that all makes sense, and that's really interesting. David, what are you thinking on vision?
A lot, all the time. It's always a perpetual question. It was really, as the metaverse develops, which everybody thinks is just some amoebic thing, it's becoming quite clear. It's turning into like a multiverse, not to, write off Marvel here, but it really is like multiple different like worlds kind of colliding together. It's not really the same Oasis kind of imagination that people are thinking of. It's going to be like all interconnected, where you're seeing like, ApeCoin coming out with their community all the way to Axies and stuff like that. Play to Earn is kind of hitting a moment of criticism right now. But these different worlds that's kind of being built on top, on top of blockchain ecosystems, they're definitely going to be driven by value. It's not like any of us played Diablo 2 because it was fun. We played it because of the economy. And all these economies, like, they are almost, they're better understood as proto-nations or
proto-economies than really visualizing them as like as companies, because it's a decentralized network of users that are trying to increase their value on their assets by playing into some sort of labor game, which is super saturated into manufactured capital, which is kind of represented through NFTs. Now, how you utilize that capital and increase your returns and kind of manage kind of like the systems and economic systems on top of these games, that's going to be a question of capital costs, because when it comes to hard assets, borrowing is the most important. And as everything becomes borrowed against, interest rates are most important. So we've already started being this like human powered DAO to figure out and become the largest kind of lender on these existing P2P lending platforms. And as these lending platforms can grow, as Connor was saying, we're kind of evolving from that credit fund into almost like a bank structure. And as that bank kind of establishes itself in terms of providing the liquidity that's necessary, the only thing that'll matter is interest rate. And that's kind of like a Federal Reserve model, where we want to be the interest rate protocol for the entire metaverse in the future, where people are competing to lower their interest rates for the specific metaverse in this multiverse metaphor. And as you lower those costs of capital by, for example, using our platform, that's how you can grow the GDP of, well, your user base, because there is a cold start problem when it comes to cost of capital within, say, Union Nations. And instead of depending on like a Washington consensus for determining rates, which is kind of like a weird system we have in the world today, where everything's looking at the US, even though you're in like China or something, but you still care about it. That kind of power and thinking should be also decentralized. So when it comes to the fixed rate protocol for the entire metaverse, that's really the ultimate goal of what we want to be. And this is also where you can get really creative with financial instruments in the future as well, where you're getting like kind of a composable layer that can build on top of MetaStreet. And we don't think we've reached a critical mass for NFT finance or metaverse finance, as people are talking about. We're still in the early experimentation stages, early standardization phases, where even 721s are quite limiting in what you can do with it. You can't, for example, right now, it's really hard to borrow and rent at the same time of a single asset, whereas that's the very basis of the real estate industry, where you can borrow, there's a mortgage yield and there's a rental yield. And that difference is how you make money.
Yeah, that was going to be a question I meant to pop in earlier, but right now it seems like the majority of underwriting is against, you know, profile picture projects, you know, art type projects. Have you really seen a proliferation of any lending against gaming assets?
And it's hard to,
you know, it seems like one of the big unlocks that everybody's trying to solve for is being able to either financing of purchasing of gaming assets, or even being able to take a loan against my current, you know, Axie or team of Axies, but still be able to play with them to generate yield.
Yeah.
Has anyone really solved that problem?
Well, they have solved it, but it's all permissioned because it's on Ronin. And the scholarship system wasn't even made by the Axie team, right? It was made by a community member. Which is why when you actually do a scholarship, it's like a sketchy, like a QR code, like janky experience, which somehow is a foundations of an entire industry. But there are standards that needs to be improved in the ecosystem. These are the very reasons why, obviously Axie has had its long history. It's like Loom evolving into Ronin and stuff like that. And also with the recent hack. It's hard to actually give permissions to renting an asset. So obviously the composability is harder because it is permissioned. So you have to like, these protocols are being custodied by centralized counterparties. So it's hard to build the composability there. But and games have a longer like development period too. It's not just like instantaneous where you create a game and you can create like a full flowing economy. It took X years to do that. So we're excited to see GameFi like kind of evolve the standards. There's been some EIP protocols that have attempted to do mortgages/rentals at the EIP layer. But we're also seeing rental protocols coming out for that too. But it's still really immature, like I'm saying, which is why we're excited for when MetaFi/NFTFi to kind of take off in terms of a composable narrative where people can really rely on the standards of the underlying protocols. And hopefully we're one of the primitives for the future.
Yeah, yeah. MetaFi, I'm going to steal that. I've been saying NFT-Fi, but it's misleading since there is an NFT-Fi project. So I like that. You talked about the decentralization of kind of this interest rate setting. You know, if Metaverse accomplishes its goal, you can start to act somewhat as like an interest rate director for the broader Metaverse economy, which makes a ton of sense, right? So like to make it more tangible, if I'm underwriting or if I'm originating a loan against a CryptoPunk and I want to do a 20% LTV loan for 30% interest rate, but Metaverse or MetaStreet, excuse me, is only buying 20% LTV for 20% interest rate, then I may not have the liquidity that I want. Or I guess that higher yield, if I can underwrite it, I'll be able to have that liquidity, but like lower yield, you won't be able to sell it, and it won't be as easy to gain liquidity on your assets. So then everybody starts to converge to what this liquidity market is willing to pay for the originations. How are you thinking about decentralizing how MetaStreet is setting those terms of what it will accept, what it will buy, what it will sell?
Yeah, so that goes into sort of that. Those kinked linear formulas that we were talking about. And so the way we see this unfolding over time is we basically have, you know, a couple of different participants within our ecosystem. So there's capital depositors, there's node originators, implicitly there's capital borrowers who are sort of one layer removed from us. And then you have kind of the governor, right? The participant who's tying all of those people together and is acting as the sort of allocator of capital. And so the way we see this working is we sort of have minimum and maximum, like LTVs and durations and things that are set kind of at the protocol level. But then within each vault, the governors are able to sort of move that target on the curve. So it's like the curve is like, you know, sort of looks a bit like a right angle or something like that. And you move that target up and down the curve based on the appetite of, you know, where the governors want the kind of target LTVs to look or target durations to look. Those governors are also allocating the amount of dollars that are going to the different NFT projects in question. So let's say you have a $10 million vault, you've got, you know, CryptoPunks, Bored Ape Yacht, and, you know, CyberKongs in there. How the actual allocation is split between those different NFT projects is up to those governors. And what happens is the governors have, there's all sorts of sort of like vote amplification things that we're going to be involving to sort of ensure that governors act in a way that's like sort of mutually aligned with capital efficiency and underwriting risk appropriately, which I won't go into in great detail here. But the ultimate idea is that those governors are earning a share of the interest income based on their ability to hit target utilization thresholds. So like the traditional finance analogy would be like some kind of fund manager who has a performance performance return metric that they have to hit, after which they'll get, you know, higher a share of profits. Similar concept. And those governors ultimately are trying to hit a utilization threshold, meaning that they're basically trying to deploy that cash in a capital efficient manner. And by doing that, the governor ultimately is controlling which NFT projects are getting more or less liquidity, and as a result, influencing kind of the interest rates. But one of the concepts that's really interesting to us to kind of unpack and see this social experiment sort of evolve is the idea of a governor who intentionally forgoes their share of that fee stream in order to allocate more capital to an NFT project than that project could even handle. And what that means is it's ultimately going to lower the cost of capital for that project in question, which isn't necessarily a bad outcome, because ultimately then the other governors are going to earn an even larger, you know, fee share relative to what they've been doing. And so there's an economic cost to doing that, but that could actually be kind of the best possible outcome for whoever that governor is in question. And that ultimately could look like, you know, different metaverses who have, you know, are trying to allocate, you know, capital to their metaverse in question to lower the interest rate in a similar format as Curve has these sort of emissions that are influencing the cost of capital, you know, in the inverse relationship. They're adding yield to these different projects, but that yield's coming from this sort of inflationary token. The idea here is if you allocate capital to different projects and that capital can't get, you know, basically absorbed, then they will have a lower cost of capital, implicitly meaning that the value of that NFT project or metaverse or whatever in question is more valuable, right? Because they are able to borrow at lower interest rates. So there's this whole sort of like really, really interesting governance angle to this whole protocol that we're super excited about, because this is where you, as David was saying, you start to see this idea of kind of decentralized control of, you know, interest rates as a whole in the metaverse, and different NFT projects kind of competing for the ability to control those rates.
Yeah. Yeah. That's I think a very clever way to align incentives and also set it up so that, you know, it's community owned and community run. And I think that's actually a good segue into, you know, when you're talking about these governors, how are you going to ensure that the governors are educated, sophisticated, you know, allocators of capital? Or, I mean, they aren't the actual, in some ways, they're the allocators, but like the setters of these rates. Could you maybe speak a little bit to the education of your user base, how you're thinking about gamifying governance? Because I think one of the exciting things for me about your project is, you know, speaking about it verbally here, it sounds pretty heady and pretty complex, but I think you've done a really good job of beautifully simplifying it down for actual users of the platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I can jump in here. I really liked what obviously I think everybody likes it because they're all adopting it with Curve governance, with regards to this like pseudo like token curated registry system where people are kind of using their gateway system, which we're adopting as well in terms of gateway voting. But we also try to encourage, education is definitely going to be the number one issue when it comes to onboarding the broader retail. It's kind of the identity crisis when it comes to like DeFi NFTs. Because if you talk to somebody who's only been in NFTs, like truly a user interview, they don't even know what yield is sometimes. It's tough. And obviously the DeFi people have no idea why a cute cat is worth like thousands of dollars. So this convergence of this new audience, which is still not really defined as like a full community yet, hence the narrative, that's still being worked out. And we take that into consideration for our education game, which is kind of what we're developing in terms of how you govern the platform. I don't like to say gamification per se, because it's just usually oversimplified. So you just add some glitter. We actually want to turn into a full-fledged game where participants in our platform, well, they go through like I call it like a shipwright program. It's kind of like underwriting, but shipwriting. And as they develop and increase in levels, we're partnering with a group called Otter Space to kind of elevate the levels where they have to go on testnet. They have to like learn how exactly debt works, why like, you know, the valuation matters today, but it matters even more so in like 30, 60, 90 days out, because that's the point of expiry. And as they like, you know, complete these tasks, and do on-chain activities, they actually get increased voting power. And we're kind of trying to think also beyond just delegation, which is like the easy and kind of the lazy route of like, hey, somebody else can do it for me. And kind of moving toward how do we empower individuals, and that they show their work, then they can actually demonstrate it with actual voting power that's, given to them for doing that labor. The second part of this is actually this gateway system, which we're also trying to evolve. So it's not a single gateway system. The reason why you have bribing as even a concept is because it is, well, plutocratic politics, essentially, where the rich, you're trying to subsidize the rich to vote for you. Yeah. And the fact that we're using bribe is dystopian. Like, it's, yes, it's true capitalism, but it's, you literally call it bribe.
unfettered capitalism.
Exactly. And we're trying to make it, we're trying to make a bug into a feature here. It's one of our favorite moments where there's really three gauge weights. And when it comes to fixed term, fixed rate, it's LTV, it's the duration, and it's the interest rate or target utilization. And those three things, as Connor was saying, is all put into this like weighted average cost of capital calculation. And those are actually three components they can vote for. And instead of going on Snapshot and feel like total boredom when it comes to voting, it feels like work really when you're on Snapshot and people are begging you. If you've really been in a DAO, like people are just on their knees, like, can you please vote for this every other week? We're trying to do like a not only reward system. So if you vote correctly, you get rewarded capital, but also a ship buoyancy system
because instead of thinking you have to vote on a snapshot vote, which, you know, it's definitely an important cornerstone of the current like DeFi ecosystem, we want to make it a little more fun, at least, where instead of, say, upgrading LTV, you might be upgrading the whole of the ship. And we're building out that, we invested quite a bit in our design team, but it will feel like you're almost like a ship manager, where you're trying to like optimize the ship so it maintains buoyancy, and so that you can have the maximum amount of delivery and obviously best returns of goods, but at the same time, you don't want the cargo to capsize. So that's the goal. It's like, how do you get the cargo across these portals in this lore that we're building? Well, you have to optimize a ship based on the resources that are put in. And it's the same concepts because it's delivery. There's yield being made, which is the return on shipment. At the same time, you're upgrading the sail, hull, or like the cargo. But you don't really realize you're doing the, you're optimizing the capital markets of the metaverse. And that's like our ultimate goal. A lot of that will be explained if you, you know, go through our shipwright training program, which is what we're developing. It's something we're definitely very conscious about in terms of educating our user base so that they understand that it's not as hard as it looks. It's just really three variables that they're trying to optimize for. And hopefully it becomes fun. Yeah.
And for the current listeners, how far along is that shipwright program? I personally have been taking part, so.
it's already up. If you go through our Discord, we call it Trade Weaver because you're essentially trying to open trade routes inside in the multiverse metaphor, where there's portals, different multiverses, and trying to get that connected, and you're like a merchant. So you can check that out on our Discord right now, where there'll be a link to essentially start the program. And as you increase your levels, well, your voting power also increases, which also magnifies your returns in the end. So feel free to check that out. It's on our discord.gg/metastreet is where you can start.
Nice. And I to one of your points earlier that I was going to compliment you on, I thought it was smart in your current governance that you did negative consent for the exact reason you discussed, where actually getting, there's an army of projects trying to solve DAO governance and DAO tooling to make this better, make it more seamless, get people more actively involved. But right now, herding cats to get votes passed can be a huge headache. And I think that negative consent incentivizes those that really care to step up and like vote accordingly.
Yeah. So that's a legal term. In crypto, I've heard people call it optimistic approval, if you want to
optimistic
put that around.
Optimistic approval, okay.
Yeah, so instead of negative consent, like, oh, you didn't vote? Oh, that's a yes. Okay. that's because you're optimistic, right? But yeah, that's something we're adopting right now. So it gives more right to veto power, which is good. But yeah, we might switch it to optimistic approval. That's a much more comforting phrase.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, I think that's most of what I have. Is there anything else that you all want to make sure our users are aware of?
I think the one thing I just wanted to end with was kind of timeline and of where we are today and where we're kind of going to be in the near term and like what's actionable. So obviously the Trade Weaver stuff is happening real time. We're actually going to have a level 3 come out hopefully this week. But we are pretty close to being ready for like a closed beta. So that'll probably be happening in the next month or so. And after that, you know, we'll basically be off to the races, you know, going through audits and all that right now. But this whole decentralized credit fund experiment will basically be coming to an end and we'll be turning into, you know, opening this product out for everyone. So in terms of people that are like interested in this and are interested in kind of getting more involved, would encourage everyone to explore Trade Weaver, keep an eye out for, you know, the product itself launching in the near term. And I just wanted to make sure people knew that, you know, these are fairly near term actionable. And we're super excited to get this thing, you know, off the ground after a pretty good amount of time, you know, deliberating and thinking and obviously coding it all up. So
we're also hiring.
Oh yeah. What are you hiring for? What are you looking for?
So
All over, all things, but mostly, obviously, devs, front end, back end, API, all the way to even our design team. We're expanding, so always open to hearing the community kind of come together, especially the ones that are native. I know most of you guys are retired, but if you want to have fun, you can feel free to hit us up. But yeah,
that makes sense. And then Connor, so in the actual beta, how will individuals really be able to get involved? Like at that point, will I, as a retail investor, be able to put my capital into some of the vaults and then also take part in governance? Or will that still be more, MetaStreet spinning these vaults up off of its own balance sheet? And then the way for individuals to get involved will be on the governance and learning component, which then evolves out into an open protocol thereafter?
Yeah. So in the closed beta, things will be pretty white glove in terms of how people can get involved. It'll be primarily on the capital providing and selling notes side of things. The governance itself, we're going to roll out in phases. I think one of the challenges with people rolling out governance and then having subsidized yields and stuff from liquidity farming is you just don't know what is actual market equilibrium before you start adding all these crazy incentives. And so we basically want to see how everything, reacts in the wild and then start to introduce the governance and decentralization process in sort of a deliberate and slow time duration to introduce this piece by piece. So that we actually have a seamless transition into governance where by the time it's fully, fully decentralized, there's a lot of users who are super up to speed on how this all works and what's kind of optimal and what's not and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's wise not to just toss it all out into the wild at once. And then from the other side, projects that are interested in getting financing against their assets, I imagine that during beta, it will be a whitelisting kind of process. Do you have any details on how your whitelisting works or ultimately how projects will get onboarded once it's into open once the project's completely open?
Yeah, that'll be probably a process of more data science than before we open up to the community. We just have to understand the realities of, some NFTs are more liquid, some are less. And spot liquidity does matter when it comes to the credit position. So we'll probably start with the most liquid assets, which can be referred to any index when it comes to crypto, from index co-op all the way to Bitwise or also really love what FloorDAO and NFTX are also doing with regards to opening up that process. But at the beginning, it will be the blue chip assets, things with high liquidity, good history. And as we open up the process, we definitely want to bring on new communities who are the most incentivized to lower their interest rates and also increase their borrowing for, because that's they get true liquidity is the borrowing markets. We're actively willing to work with any projects that have been kind of desperate for liquidity and be an avenue for them and to collaborate at the project level too. Hopefully, and whether you're a big NFT fund or if you're an NFT project yourself with some liquidity and you're trying to upgrade that, then feel free to reach out.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate it, guys. This was a great conversation. And thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks, man. It was great.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Delphi podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on your podcast app, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter or LinkedIn. Stay tuned for our next episode, out soon.